about open source software and servers and things like that. And I was like, this does not happen to me in Washington. Why do they talk about $700 billion bailouts? They never talk about open source software. So, let's see, and I really did go to Twitter for a same thing. Which is a story in and of itself, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. So, what comes out of my community? Now, this one also happened to me in San Francisco. So, what I was doing in San Francisco is the Mellon Foundation has funded a project in which they are, they're trying to find commonalities in the kinds of things that people who work in the humanities need from digital tools. So the example of the group from University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Chicago that put this together, the example they use is everybody needs authentication services. You shouldn't have to remember 100 different passwords. You should have one password that should provide access to everything, like the library does now. Right, you've got a university password, and now you have everything a library has, everything the university has, off that one password. That's because there's a service that you can go to. So what are the kinds of services do humanities people need? Well, they need services to find things. They need services to annotate things. They need services to help them make sense of things. They need services to publish things. So this project's trying to make an inventory of those kinds of services, and then hire programmers to build those core services, which people can then put together in higher level pieces to serve humanists without having to reinvent the wheel from the ground up. So that's the idea. So what did these people do? Well, they got a bunch of money from Mellon to run a series of workshops. Then they held a series of workshops in really great places like Paris. And so people went to them. This one was in San Francisco. This is the fifth workshop, which they call Workshop 2. They had workshop 1, A, B, C, D, right? And then this is workshop 2 to try to put together some of the stuff that happened in 1, A, B, C. And they have a wiki. So a wiki is a piece of collaborative software in which anybody can edit, right? Just like Wikipedia. So Wikipedia is just one usable wiki. So they have a wiki. And one of the fellows working on the project, who was on the technology side, so they have technology people talking to humanities people. And I found it funny because they kept talking about, you know, the IT people and the faculty. Wait a minute, the faculty are IT people. But that wasn't in their mental model. Their mental model was people who worked on IT and people who worked, you know, in the faculty. And so we had, we had one of the IT people mentioned to me that they had all this great information on the wiki, but nobody was using it. So the people that showed up in San Francisco, 150 people flew at their own expense to San Francisco for this meeting, and stayed for 3 days. So, I mean, this is like, you know, two-person years of work went on in this three-day meeting. These people hadn't spent the time to go through the wiki. And so, I actually mentioned this the last day, so why is it that people will go to San Francisco, but they won't go to the wiki? Because the wiki had all the content. But then I realized that in San Francisco, they had this wonderful arrangement where they had different tables that we all sat at, round tables. You walked in, you found somebody you knew, you sat at the table, a few more people assembled, and then they gave the table an assignment and you started working together on it. And then they broke up the people, sent them to breakout rooms, gave them structured assignments, and then they had them sign up for their groups, and they went back and forth between, you know, group sessions and individual, you know, breakout sessions. They really thought about how to run a meeting. The meeting was 3 days long, because you know how meetings work. The first day, you learn what the problem is, the second day you conclude it's impossible, and the third day you sort of start to see the light, right? I mean, this was really a masterfully done meeting. But the wiki was just a set of hierarchically organized stuff. And so just imagine you coming to the wiki. Imagine that the wiki was San Francisco, right? So you flew into the wiki, and here you are, and you get to the meeting site, and it's just a bunch of stacked up documents and a place to hang post-it notes. And that's the meeting, right? So what they needed was some way of building a community around the content in the wiki. And they were doing that in person, masterfully. But they hadn't thought in as nuanced a way about how do you build a community around the content of the wiki. And so the wiki was just sort of a pile, whereas the meeting was intensely interactive. So you can look at this and you can say, I see what to do. I should send out an email every day that says, this thing's updated on the wiki, please take a look. Right, and start to drive traffic to specific places in the wiki. So yeah, click here, it'll take you right there. You don't have to remember your login or anything, just click here. If you got the email, you got the magic password, it'll take you right into the wiki. If they were to do that, they'd start to create something like the meeting that occurred. Yeah? And so you have to think about online communities to think about how to drive traffic around like that. Now, the question somebody asked was, what's the role of content in an online community? Imagine instead of having content in there, what they did was they flew us all to San Francisco, and then at the end of the meeting they said, okay, we're going to create an empty wiki. You guys can all keep interacting if you like after you go home. Nothing would work, right? There'd be nothing specific to do. There'd be no focus. So creating an online community from scratch is very hard. And they've got the first half of it. They've got the content. They've got the second half of it. They've got the people who voted with their feet and went to San Francisco. Now all they need is the process, right? Whereas if they didn't have the content, it wouldn't matter how much they thought about the process, because there wouldn't be anything to do there. Now, once there was something to do there, then the people might be routinely going there, and the content would become vestigial after at some point. The content wouldn't be the reason to get there. But content as a seed for an online community is useful. Okay, so that's what that was about. Further questions on this? I owe you an answer to the third. But today, we are going to have a lot of fun. This is like geek heaven today. Because I really only get three chances to change the way you think of OLS. The first chance was the first couple of weeks when you walked in and you were just waiting to be shaped, right? What is the class going to be about? And the answer was, it's the network. The storage hierarchy and the last thing in the storage hierarchy is the network. It's all that other stuff out there. I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way, but that's really what's going on. There's one more step out in the storage hierarchy. So that's the world in which we now live, and the world in which I think we'll live for quite some time. It's all about the network. What's on it, why that's on it, what we do with it. We've kind of gotten now that consolidated. Today, we're going to take a different cut. It's as if you walked into a different class. It's as if we're starting over. We're going to work on what is a database. We're very sloppy in the way we use our language. So we say things like, I have a database of pictures. Now, what does that mean? It means I have a bunch of pictures. Right? I got a file folder full of pictures. Right? Maybe we it draws to mind I have some way of finding them. You know, there's some metadata on my pictures, so now I've got a database of pictures. We're going to be much more formal with what we mean by a database. And as we do that, we're going to develop a way of thinking that's appropriate for thinking about data and for how we manipulate data. After we learn that, the third of these, which we'll get to in 2 weeks, so they come pretty fast and furious now, is we're going to learn about programs. And it turns out that there are only three things you have to know to understand programs. And that all the complexity comes from the way those three things are put together. So we'll put that off for a little while, 2 weeks. And we'll spend this week and next week on how databases work. Now, if you'll remember, when we did web characterization, there was the surface web and then the deep web. And the deep web, you had to ask a query get the information from a database and have it generated for display. And almost all the information that's accessible through the internet was in the deep web, not the surface web. So this is not small stuff. This is the way in which the majority of the world's well-structured information is managed. So, we start by asking some questions. What is data? We keep talking about it. Anybody want to try? Just a wonder.
Information.
Data is information. Okay, so this is making my second question more complex. My second question was going to be, what's information? So I'm actually not going to let you have information as an answer to data because I wanted to find out how is information different from data?
Data is meaningful information?
Either that or information is meaningful data.
Well, information can be anything, right? I mean, anything can be construed as information, anything that's interesting to them. But something that is, data is usually descriptive and has been logged away for some ultimate reason.
So I actually want to flip that.
Data are discrete building blocks of something.
Where did you get that from?
Numbers, or they could be...
No, where did you get that idea from?
I've morphed the databases for the past 3 years.
Okay.
We're all into crazy stuff.
So database
not
people...
Local, but those, I mean, that's stuff.
Database people think of data as atomic, factual, decontextualized.
Yeah. Stop. Okay, data is
the answer to a question. You have a question for to seek data. So whether it's the data for whatever data you have, it's to answer some sort of question.
Okay, so if I tell you 42, that could be data. It doesn't make sense until you have the question to put it in context. So now I can manipulate 42. I can store 42 in an appropriate place so that when I ask the right question, I get 42 as the answer. So if I told you that the temperature in Anchorage is 42 in Fahrenheit. Temperature in Anchorage in Fahrenheit is 42. Now you have contextualized data. We might call it information. So there's this pyramid. Have some information that we can construct from our data further up. So information is in some sense data in context. Now, if I ask you, do you need a coat if it's 42 degrees and you want to go outside? What's that?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. You might want one. What's that? So, what to do with this information, we could call knowledge. Right? So it makes this pyramid, it's got data on the bottom, then it's got information, contextualized data, and then it's got knowledge, which is the basis for making decisions. So if I tell you it's 42, and when it's 42, it would be good to wear a coat, then you have something more than just information. You can make a decision. So, in our dreams here, we're conveying knowledge to you at a university. In your dreams, we're giving you the answer to the exam questions, which is data. Right? You simply put that answer in this place on the page, and you will get a good grade. So that's data. Information is something that is, you know, is that the answer to this question? And knowledge is what we hope we're really measuring, which is, can you go do things in the world with what we're telling you? Right? So you can think of books as containing information, but not knowledge. The people who write books contain knowledge. The people who read books contain knowledge. But the book itself would be information in this way of cutting up the world. So there's a level even above knowledge if you build this pyramid. Have you guys really not talked about this in 601? Anybody taking 601? Mm-hmm. And it's not there?
No,
it's
not.
It is?
Yeah.
It's above the pyramid? Okay. What's that? Okay. Cool. So this is, you guys are giving me look like, really? Are you making all this up? So these are just names for ideas, right? It doesn't matter what we, you know, whether we call them this or something else. It's useful to have this as common vocabulary. So the very top layer of this is wisdom. Right? So knowing you should wear a coat and deciding to wear the coat are different things, right? This works fairly well with nuclear weapons at this point, right? So we have the knowledge to make nuclear weapons. We have the wisdom not to use them. And those are sort of different levels. Now, nobody that I know of has yet tried to build a wisdom base. Right? So if we rip down this hierarchy, the first place you encounter anything like a database isn't what people call a knowledge base. A knowledge base is like a database, except it also has rules, and it uses the database to extract the rules. So a knowledge base is an attempt to automatically tell you which decisions to make. So expert systems will often refer to what they're doing as a knowledge base. So they'll go interview a doctor and they'll say, okay, when a patient comes in, what do you ask him? And you say, you know, where does it hurt? Right? And if they point to their toe, then, you know, you say, have you stubbed your toe recently or something like this, right? So that would be this, you know, what do you ask them first? And if they say this, what do you say next? And so there's some structured representation of knowledge. Usually incomplete. For example, if the person's missing their toe, they might not know what to do then, right? Because their toe is where it hurts, but there is no toe, and that wasn't anticipated by them. Okay, that's knowledge. We're not going to talk about knowledge bases any further just now. If you go down a level further, you get to, you think information bases or something, but for historical reasons, they've been called information retrieval systems. So if I want to find a document, then I would use an information retrieval system. Search engine, and it would give me some contextualized information. Something like the weather in Anchorage today, temperature is 34, partly cloudy. Yeah. Okay, so that would be information retrieval. We'll actually talk about that in 5 or 6 weeks. It's way simpler than database. Right? It's what I do all my work. So it's also much fun. But if we go down a little further, we get to this original problem, 42. I want to get 42 out when I ask the question, what's the temperature in Anchorage? And so what do? I make up a table, I put 42 in it, I have some way of issuing a query that can get 42 out of the table, I'm done. That's what we're going to talk about. Okay? So we call it a database because it's a collection of data and it's organized in a way that will support access. We do not need a relational database to use that name. Any collection of data organized in any way, we could call a database. We're only going to talk today about a relational database, which I'll get to in a minute. Really important, hard to overstate the importance of. will pervade the next part of the semester, the next 4 weeks, is that a database is a model of reality. So, for example, I could keep track of the height, weight, and age of every person here. And that would be a database. In fact, we have something like that. I keep track of the name and weight of every person here. Right? But neither of those are realities. Indeed, you have a height and a weight, an age, and you have a name and a grade. And one of those is useful for one purpose. For example, if I want to sell you some clothes, maybe I want your height and weight. Right? Whereas if I want to record your grade, maybe I need your name and your grade. So the some aspect of reality is encoded in our database, not just in the data, but in the way we can answer questions from the data. Right? So it's not just what we store, but what we can do with what we store. Okay, so it's a model of reality, just like a toy model rocket is a model of a rocket. It's just like the real rocket in some ways, different in others. Like maybe it's smaller, maybe not a plastic. Now, people will often call Microsoft Access a database. But it's not. It's a system for making databases. Right? It would be like my calling a programming language a program. It's not. The system for making programs. So when you're being precise, you can make a distinction between the database, which is the collection of data organized to support access, and the database management system, which is the computer software that you are using to represent the database. Now, here's the real trick to the whole thing. A fellow named Codd, back in the 1960s, figured out that you could make efficient databases, databases that used limited amounts of memory and could answer your queries relatively quickly, if you organize them in a certain way so that you could ask for the answer by the characteristics of the answer rather than telling the program how to find the answer. So you would just say, find me everything like this, and it would find it for you without you having to tell it how to do that. So you didn't have to actually program it. You could specify what you wanted the result to be, and it would give you that result. And the thing that Codd figured out was that there was a branch of mathematics, technically in mathematics and algebra, called the relational algebra, that will allow the computer to find the most efficient way of computing what you wanted using an automatic process for optimization. And so IBM made a move on building databases using this relational algebra, and a whole group, a whole profession grew up that learned how to design databases using the relational algebra. And a whole cadre of 690 students ever since have cursed Codd because he couldn't figure out whether he was actually doing the database lingo or the relational lingo. So the relational algebra has its own name for things, and the relational database has its own things, and they're the same things, but you sound so much more sophisticated if you use all the math terms. And so database people move back and forth between these two. They represent everything with tables. And tables, you know, have columns and rows. So you, any sensible person would call these things columns and rows. But no, if you're going to do the relational algebra, these become attributes or fields and tuples. Anyway, we'll get that. So relational and relational databases comes from this. And although in database classes, people will get up and they'll say, ooh, so there are hierarchical databases, there are network databases, there are all these databases, and the only one we're ever doing relational databases. So you cannot forget all that. So I'm not even going to tell you all that, you can forget it instantly, you can forget it. The relational algebra took over the world in the database. Okay. So, what do I have if I've got a database? Well, I'm going to have something like 32. And I'm going to store it someplace, and I'll call that a field. So I might have the latitude of Anchorage, the longitude of Anchorage, the name of Anchorage, the state in which Anchorage is found, the country in which Anchorage is found, and the temperature. Right? And so the field will be the temperature, for example, or the latitude, or whatever. It could be a number, it could be a string, it could be a true or false, but it can't be two things. It has to be atomic. So, for example, my name is Doug Ward. So, is that one name or two? Somebody, two. Anybody want to go for one?
It's up to the person designing the database.
If they wish to think of names as atomic units, if they never want to ask, sort by last name. That's not one of their questions. Then they don't need to know which part's the first name and which part's the last name. I know a fellow named Gareth G.F.J. Jones. So just imagine what some system that, you know, so you see these funny things where, you know, his first name has to be Gareth G.F.J., right? And the last name can be Jones? Right? Or people from Spain, you know, they've got this list of names that goes on for a very long time. So, if I think of the name as one thing, that's good for a certain kind of answer to a certain kind of question. Remember when I said we're going to model an aspect of reality? You decide what aspect of reality you're going to model, and then that tells you what's atomic, what's a single element in what you're going to do. Right? So 42 is not 4 in the 10th place and 2 in the 1th place. It's 42. But it could have been 4 in the 10th place and 2 in the 1st place, depending on what it was you were trying to do. Clear what a field is? Clear how you get there from some specification of a problem? Okay, good. So a record is a collection of related fields. So I've got some record in my database. So I've got a database that has no records in it. I'll put a record in. It'll be Anchorage, Alaska, 42. College Park, notice, one word. College Park, Maryland, 68. Right? Each of these is a record. It's the set of related fields. A table is a collection of records. So the table I just told you has two records in it. And you can draw it. Well, I can't because I don't know the tellers, but you could draw it as a table with columns and rows. We make the columns the fields. We make the rows the records. We go ahead. Now, that's all the simple part. Here's where it starts to get fun. If I want to refer to one of the rows, I need a name for that row. And it turns out we're going to need to do this. I'm going to need to say that row. So I'm going to need some way of uniquely specifying that row. Now, a very simple way you can do that is that you can simply number your rows. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, so on and so forth. But then if you come along and you delete row 7, I don't have any problems. I can still uniquely refer to a row. Yes? Now, if I go along and I insert a new row, I can always get the number one bigger than the previous one. So, I need to have some way of referring to a row. We're going to call that way the primary key, and we're going to require that it be unique. Now, if I had Doug Ford, and there was nobody else named Doug, then I could use Doug if I wanted to. That would be allowed. But it'd be a little unsafe if somebody else got born later and got named up. So, easiest thing to do for a primary key is to simply add an extra field, make it unique. Okay. Now, what's a database? A database is a collection of tables. So here's an example. I could have in my database a table that described members, which this guy defined. I could have a table that describes membership plans. I could have a table that describes who the personal trainers are, and one that describes the training sessions. Now, the member table would look like you expected. It would have the name of the member. It would have the maybe their phone number, their address. It would have the stuff you expect to be in. And one of the fields in there would be a code that would say what kind of a membership this person has. So, for example, this person might have a prime time membership, which costs $45.50. And instead of writing prime time, which would take a lot of space, we'll just write P inside the member table. And then we can look up P anytime we need it and find out whatever additional information we need. So this gives you more compact coding, but it links your tables now. So this membership code is a link from the member file to the membership plan file. Member table to the membership plan. Got it? Okay, so in this table, where is the primary key?
Your code.
Okay, so the membership code is unique. That means I can't have another R someplace down here, but that's okay because I made up the code. Right. So you've seen primary keys all over the place. You get a couple of these. A student ID number on it. Primary key. In the student table for the university. Right. Make a reservation on an airplane lately. You got a reservation number, primary key on your reservation. Okay, so you've been dealing with primary keys your entire life, and they've never called them primary keys. There's actually a law about primary keys. Anybody know the Privacy Act of 1974, what it says about Social Security numbers? What's that? It's actually for other things. Only for specific purposes, and it's illegal to use it for other purposes. Why? Well, because it would allow you to put together databases to link information about the same person. For example, your health records with your financial records with your tax records. So this is why your student number is not your Social Security number. It actually was when I first started here, my Social Security number.
Yeah, that was in
the 70s, but they passed the Privacy Act of 1974. Yeah, that's actually
what you said. It took them until, like, just a couple years ago. Because
it exempts the state government.
Okay.
So it does not, the Privacy Act of 1974 does not affect the ability of private entities to use your Social Security number. It affects the ability of the federal government to do it because it was a concern about the federal government maintaining records on its citizens.
Right.
Right? And then, of course...
You think you still don't want everyone else and their brother using your Social Security number?
Yes, but you have no legal obligation to give anyone else your Social Security number. Well, at least not private entities. State governments were a bit of a problem for a while. And then they got that stuff as well. I think by state.
Because yeah, I know like in Ohio until a couple of years ago you had to have your Social Security number on your driver's license, and now they say no, you can't put it on there.
And my military ID card still has it.
Yeah.
So, which is one of the allowed federal privileges. Okay. So, enough on from IT. So here's what we want to do. We want to actually build a database, and in this database, we're going to record which students are in which classes. So this is a kind of a nice example, because whatever problem you work on, you've already worked on this one just to get it. So we're going to record which students are in which classes. Here's what we know about the students. We'll know their first name, their last name, their email address, and what department they're in. And then for the courses, we'll need a description of the course, enrolled students, which students are enrolled, and those students' grades. Okay? That's what we want to record. Now, there's an easy solution for this. We can do it all in one table. Or we can do a two-table solution. So the two-table solution is really obvious, right? This is one table, this is the other table. There's a student table and a courses table. What's the primary key here? The course ID. So we don't get any two courses here the same ID, right? So how many of you have gone to the general ed section so far? Is this course ID different? The section number is different. So we're going to need a course ID and a section number in the semester. As the section number might be the same in a previous semester. Okay. So indeed, we use course ID, semester, and section number as a compound primary key, because that combination is unique. Okay. How about up here? Primary key?
Last name.
What's that?
Last name.
Last name. Okay. Any two people here have the same last name? No, as it turns out. Well, what do you bet at the university? Not a good choice.
University ID
number, which is not here, right? Because it's not a part of the problem we're trying to solve. So when we start by writing out a specification and say, I need to know this, we don't always think of the primary key. So you need to invent a primary key for every table, because you were the one that invented the table. Right? You're using a table as a convenience. I already told you there's a one-table solution to this, there's a two-table solution to this, and we won't use either one. Yeah.
We could be.
Let's see. Yeah, that would be perfect. What's that? Okay, so here's a single-table solution. Right? We don't need two tables. Here we've made up a student ID. I got the last name of the student, the first name of the student, I got their department. As an ID code, I've got their department spelled out. I've got the ID of the course. Skip over all that other problem of section numbers. I got the ID of the course. I got the course description, which is just the title. I got their grade. You can see most of the people are doing pretty well in this class. And I got their email address, which I could have used as a primary key button. Good solution? No, or not?
But there's too much redundancy. Like the first four columns there, you've got one arrow John EE, and then the next row, you repeat the same thing, and then the same for the next person.
Well, this is bad. I don't really
know
how to
read it. All of their name and department information stay the same no matter what class they're taking.
Actually, they don't stay the same. What fraction of the people do you think that bought Microsoft Access never made a database that has more than one table? Almost everybody, right? Because they skipped this class. Okay, so it's a really bad idea to try to solve problems like this with a single database, because you get inconsistency. There,
because you're getting consistency here, because you get wasted information once I tell you this, you know that, except here it's mistyped, right? Not even detectively, and here again, right? So, it would be good if we could build up two table solutions to this. Now, when we do this, we're going to try to save space. But realize now, when I take one table and make it into two tables, I'm going to need a primary key for each of those tables now. And so, there are some cases where I'm not going to save space. But most of those cases are cases where either it's a very small database, or cases in which you shouldn't have actually put things into different tables, because they would have just done equally well together. So if you never need to take something apart, then you waste space by taking them apart.
How about if you wanted to build on the layers then? Would it have been better to have them locked?
Yes, so you have to design for all future uses, and this is a big problem in databases, is that remember that you're modeling reality, some part of reality, for some purpose. And there are two problems with that purpose business. One is, you might not have completely understood the purpose and thus not have made a good model, and something that was in your original purpose, you need to refactor the database for. Or alternatively, your purpose might change over time, which is happening just constantly with the student databases. You know, I got some letter from the university today that said, congratulations on being a veteran, we're now opening up a new veteran something or other. I gotta believe when they made that database, they hadn't thought that they were gonna wanna send a letter to all the veterans on campus sometime later, but you know, then the war started and 5 years later they wanna send letters to all the veterans, so somebody had to go and put that in. Okay, so one purpose is to save space. The second thing is that if I update something, if, for example, I was originally a student at WE, but later I became a faculty member in the iSchool, all you have to do is go in and change my affiliation from one place to the other, change my status from student to faculty, and you're done, right? So you don't have to go in and read some big complex set of things and then change what you want and then write it back out, right? So you get more rapid updates when only small parts are changing. This is really important if I'm running a store, for example, where people are constantly buying things and I'm ordering them replacements, and then the replacements are arriving and I have them on the shelf. So if I'm constantly doing updates, I want to keep those updates in a very small part of my database, and then I'll just keep that small part of my database in main memory, in RAM. Right. And everything else will be out on disk for when I need it, when somebody comes and asks something very quick. But the stuff that I'm updating frequently, I'll just keep it in RAM. Okay, I can give you more rapid search if you want to search for, you know, what the description of this course number. Right, then you just have to search on table. And as we pointed out, it can avoid inconsistency. So, I call this idea normalization. I want to factor my table, divide up my table, in a way that creates normalized tables. Okay, so this is the awful relational algebra. We can come back if you really want. The fields are called attributes in the relational algebra. The tables themselves are called relations, and the rows are called tuples. Yep. Oh, so you know what a double is, right? Two things? Yeah, a triple? Three? Right. Well, a tuple is like what? So what really happened is they call them four tuples, five tuples, five, six tuples. It's the suffix that goes on double, triple, four tuples. Right? So tuples are just sort of generic sets of things. Now, these are sets in the mathematical sense, in that there is no order. I mean, if I tell you I have an attribute that's first name and an attribute that's last name, one doesn't come before the other or after the other. They exist in an unspecified order. And because the order is unspecified, except for printing, where you have to specify it, but because it's unspecified for the mathematics, that's one of the ways the optimization occurs, is that you can operate on some of the attributes before you operate on others. Right? So for example, if I tell you that I want to count up all the people who have a certain attribute, then an easy thing to do is just to select the people with that attribute and then count the rest. And if there are only two, then that selection operation makes the counting operation very fast. Right, instead of checking each one to see if it has the attribute. So we give the system the ability to decide on the order when there are multiple selections to be done. It can select the things that there are the fewest of quickly, and then all the future operations it has to do are on some smaller set. Okay. So the tuples have no specified order. That's the columns. And the rows have no specified order. Right? So we didn't have to have some ordered way of representing something in the primary key. They just had to be unique. And so we can reorder the rows as well as reordering the columns. And so by calling these tuples and then a relation is a set of tuples, we haven't said anything about the order of the tuples. We've left that free for optimization. Now, I have to tell you when we print it, what order to print it. Right? And so people think that that order is fixed, but really that order is being generated at printing. Okay. So, here's a set of normalized tables for the problem we were just talking about. And as you could see, you were initially thinking two-table solution might be good here, but if you tried to build the two-table solution, you would have seen that some of the problems still remain. So we have a student table, and in the student table, we've got John Arrows, who's in EE, and there's John Arrows' email address. And those things are only recorded once, and any time I want to refer to John Arrows, I can just save one. So I save a lot of space. The departments, we only have three departments, so I only have to write their name once, and then I can use their code. Now, I could have saved even more space if I created a different primary key that was numeric, then I wouldn't have to have things like CLIS or HIST. So they're perfectly good for the primary key, but now every time I want to use them, I have to actually include that information in the other table. So you can see, if this were 1, 2, 3, this would have been 3 instead of CLIS. It's better when there's meaning to encode the actual full value and let the database system do further optimization. If you have a cheaper database system, it won't. If you have a complex database system, it'll just build an extra table and replace everything with numbers. And every time we show it, you just pop the letters back in. Okay? So trying to get overly cute will make it a little bit more efficient, but you'll get more confused yourself. Because we'll be sitting here looking at, okay, well, I've got student one in course three, right? And so you just start to make it harder to read your own database. Okay, but in any case, we're saving space, maybe not as much as we could. Same deal here with courses.
But in other sense, we have a word, it's all numbers with no actual data.
Okay.
We went somewhere else to build data, so it's meaningless when you try to do it with it.
Yeah. So if you want to program easily, you're better off to keep things that are meaningful to you. Now, you can remember the trade-off between your time and the computer's time. Right? The computer's time is cheap. If it has to do a little bit of extra work, you can always buy another computer. You've only got one to use. So if you want to get your project to run by the end of the semester, pick meaningful names and make things easy to remember. Okay. There's the fourth table. And then this is the cute one. This is the one that, during the final exam, you should go to this slide and stare at. Every database question that has ever been written on any exam in this course has been written about that table. So what's the effect? Scoop 1 is an LDSC 690, Scoop 2 is an LDSC 690, and Scoop 4 is an LDSC 690. Okay? Students 2 and 3 are also in History 405. Why did I need this table? Why couldn't I just have put the courses in the student table?
Yeah. Because each student takes more than one course.
Okay, fine. So if they take three courses, I'll just put three columns. Course 1, course 2, course 3. That should work.
Well, but you want to link them with an individual grade for each course.
Okay, so I'll have course 1, grade for course 1, course 2, grade for course 2, course 3, grade for course 3.
But then if you want to look up, you know, the grade for course 3, you can't do that. You just have to read through the whole line. Whereas this way, if you have the combination of the student number and the course number, then you can just find the grade. Instead of having to look through all the long stuff about every
course. Okay, so I might gain some efficiency here. Correct. You mean there are people that take less than three courses? What's the maximum? How many courses is this?
Five.
Three courses. Yeah, so you see, it could. There's no real number of courses we could have picked. You just can't do this. But we could have done it the other way. In the course table, we could have put student 1, first student, second student, third student, fourth student, fifth student, right? I mean, there's some limit to the number of students that can take a class, right? It must be around 300. The other problem is that there might be 300 students in a class, but most classes have many fewer students, and so we would be wasting a lot of students. Okay, see, really bad. So this table doesn't mean anything. Yeah, I mean, look, there's something in the world that the department, right? That doesn't really mean anything either, right? The department's kind of fictitious. There is no department, right? I mean, it's a concept of the human mind, so what department do you want to be going to answer, but you can't hold it, right? Okay, so this doesn't really exist. How about a court? This is the only thing that actually exists, right? Is the person. Well, we're just lucky that we happen to have something that exists in our head. So tables represent entities, but entities don't have to exist. They're things, yeah, a department's a thing, it's just a non-existent thing. It's an imaginary thing. So I've got student entities, I've got department entities, I've got course entities, even though they don't really exist either. And then I need a name for this. So it's really convenient to call it enrollment. You can, I mean, it's a funny use of a noun, right? But you can say an enrollment. You have an enrollment in this class. So I don't care what you call it, this concept of an enrollment exists. Just like when I flew to California, there were many people that were customers of the airline. There were many flights, but the airline was flying. And there was a reservation for me on this flight. Okay. So there was a reservation number that was the primary key for the reservation. Does a reservation exist? Well, when you get to the airport and they can't find your reservation, you will feel that something that exists has ceased to exist, right? So it exists in some sense.
If it's just a thing, I have to have a key. If it's just usually up on those tables, there's nothing unique, like each column has subdivision.
I'm not sure I understood that one, so every table needs a primary key.
So what's the primary key in that table?
Student ID.
So, no, student ID is not a primary key, but student ID, course ID, together is a compound primary key.
Okay.
I can uniquely refer to this. Now, there's a fundamental rule in relational databases that no two rows can be identical, which means that the entire row is always a compound primary key. But it's expensive to refer to a compound primary key, so you rarely will actually use a compound primary key. You more normally would put a primary key on this and have an enrollment sign. You know, like a confirmation number or something, right? That's what a confirmation number is. It's a primary key on a table that exists only for the purpose of joining two tables. So when I say exists only for the purpose of joining two tables, what's the primary key of the student table?
Student ID.
Good. And that's the first thing in the enrollment table, right? What's the primary key of the course table? Course ID. And that's the second field here, second column in the enrollment table. So we call these, they're not primary keys, right? Because they're not unique in this table. But they are references to the primary key in another table. So we call them a foreign key. So LDSC 690 is a foreign key to the primary key in the course table. And student ID is a foreign key to the primary key in the student table. And this pairing of primary keys in two different tables exists to allow you to automatically join the tables. And that's actually not just English, that's the name of the operation, join. So here's how join works. This is a join between the student table and the department table. A different example than the one I gave you a minute ago. And in the student table, what's the foreign key?
The department ID.
Department ID, right? So what I'll do is I'll go student ID 1, arrows, John. I'll replace department ID with the entire row over here. So the department ID and department, and then email. Right? And using this, I can build back the tables, the flat table I had earlier. Right? I have two tables, and I can put them together. Just like in algebra, if I have two numbers, I can add them, or multiply them, or divide them, or subtract them. Here, if I have two tables, I can join them, and join is an operator in the relational algebra, which is how God made all this. The relational algebra is very easy to learn because it only has three operators. And not only that, two of them are brain dead. You know, like in the old version of the regular algebra, you could have 4 and then you could have minus 4. And the way you got minus 4 was you put a minus in front of 4 and what you had was minus 4. Yeah? Well, two of the operators in the relational algebra are like that brain dead. Okay? So here's one that's called project. And what I do is I start out with a really big table. And then, I wish I had a marker. I just get rid of all the stuff I don't want. But here's my table, and I'm going to get rid of this, get rid of that, and I'm left with just these two. So this operator is called project, and it's just like taking a right putting it on top of your table, cutting out a couple of places where you want the light to come through, and projecting. And all that sits to the bottom are the places the light went through. Right? So, projector on the ceiling, projecting down, that's a projector. Project six columns up, and keeps them, and wipes out everything else. Okay? Now, there are two ways to select. There are two ways to indicate which columns you want to keep. One of them is, you can put check marks by the columns in some picture of a table, and it will just keep those. We'll see that in a minute. The other is you can play it in language, right? And so here is a element of structured query language, SQL, says select student ID and department, and if you just from the name of the table, and if you throw this table, you'll end up with that table. The project operator, which is written in SQL select, just to confuse you. Really called the select operator in the relational algebra, but that would confuse you even more because the SQL select isn't the same as the select operator. So we've renamed it project. The project operator will take a table and make it into a table. Okay? And the table it makes it into will potentially have less stuff in it. Like have all the stuff in it, right? Could project everything. But it can't have any more in it than was in the original table. There are only three operators in the relational algebra, and they all take a table in and put a table out. The join operator takes multiple tables in, two, and puts a table out. The project operator takes one table in and puts a table out. And the table that takes in could have come from the join operator. And the order of operations is subject to optimization automatically by the system. That's how Todd got famous. Was that optimization business could be done automatically, guaranteeing that the result would be identical, but one way of computing it is faster than the other. So for example, you might want to project before you join, because then there's less stuff to copy around. Okay? Good? Okay. So, if there are only three operators, join puts tables together, and project keeps columns. Anybody want to guess what the third operator does? Keeps rows. So we'll call it restrict. The most common source of confusion for 690 students on final exams is getting project and restrict packets. So, when you're getting ready to take the final exam, you can write project equals columns, restrict equals rows on your top two fingers, and you still have three fingers left in case there's anything else you want to keep track of. Right? Okay. So, with restrict, I start out with a full table, and then I tell it which rows I want to keep. Now, this is the whole game in databases. How do I tell it which rows to keep? With the primary key? It'll work, right? Yes? Except it wouldn't be really useful. So it was an entire database system, and it would only do exactly what I told it to. So the magic of databases is that I can simply tell it by concept a formula for which rows to keep. So I could say, where age is greater than 30. And it would just go through and find all the ones where age was greater than 30 and keep those, throw the rest. Or where department equals history. Or anything else I want to do. Okay? So, restrict, I do by the name of the field. I'm sorry, project, I do by the name of the field. Yeah, sorry. Project, I do by the name of the field. Restrict, I do by content. And it is the restrict by content that is what databases do. That's what a database query is. So to form a database query, I have to tell you, which tables do I want to join? Then, having told you which tables I want to join, I then tell you which fields I want to keep, which columns I want to keep, then having told you that, and then ask a question of that imaginary table. That table never gets created. The one that I imagined that came from the join, and then the project, because I could have equal it all projected, and then join. But I'd be really smart to restrict before I did any of that, because when I restrict, then the join becomes much cheaper. That join is the most expensive operation around. So, if you become a really good database programmer, you learn how not to do joins. How to answer your question without doing joins. And so, you take tables that are nicely normalized, you actually denormalize them for fast access. But only for certain access paths. Did that seem really simple? What? No. Is this simple to anyone? Nobody's going to say that. Well, you guys aren't stopping. You got to learn to stop.
Can you go back three times to what I asked you? The process, what you said is you do the first by content, and then the second, or the first by field, the second.
I have a bunch of tables.
Right.
And what I want is, I want to join some of the tables,
right.
And then I want to pick out which columns I want in my answer,
right.
And then I want to specify which rows I want. That's the structure of a database first. It won't actually get run that way, but that's the way I say it to the database. Got it? Okay. Anybody want to vote for a break? You guys gotta like ask earlier, right? I can do this for 2.5 hours.
You should do it, because you have to make sure you get the right gate, too. If you're on the wrong gate, you won't be on the other security list.
I think the
very simple way of using it.
Yeah. But we had to go by.
You're definitely able to become along with it. Yes, it's maybe, right? Yeah, right here it is. You suppose that is the market's database for your market. Yeah, here's your ADR, here's the maximum profit. Yeah, so if you need one of those, it's fine. That's the main gate.
Yeah. Is that where we're coming in?
I think it's into the side gate. I just call the problem from the right gate. And I'll tell you, it's the gate or the gate or the main gate. Do you need to well, I have to ask which gate it is. The Starsky won't matter right now, which could be that dirt for us. But it should be this gate you're really right to. You know, what we do is don't want to do it long gate, then it's ours.
Thank you.
Which is the name of the directory above you, slash Club, up and back down into Buff. All right? Yes? How many people are happy? Nobody's happy? What's the matter? Tell me something was the matter. Ask a question, pick a question, any question.
One for interconnect.
What's that?
What do we do, one for interconnect?
So you're interconnect, and it should say something like Y colon, which is really obscure. What does yours do?
Z colon.
Z colon, fine. So they got a bunch of names, they're engineers, they're not very, or a bunch of machines, they're not very creative, they call them Y, Z, there's probably an X out there someplace. I'm on the machine called Y, you're on the machine called Z. What's that? Did you go to SSH?
Client.
F-Secure SSH client, not the file transfer? F-Secure SSH client. Will I am? SSH? F-Secure. This one, the one on the upper right. Yeah. And then break the net. How many people are now happy? Almost viral. You help somebody next to you become happy. How many people are seriously unhappy?
You're in.
That's what I think. I can pick that one. Who else has got problems? Nobody. Okay. Alright. So, now that we're here, you want to go. So, this is what I would have seen at login. Y colon tilde colon. Whatever the hell that is. Okay, so CD, that's change directory, space. Dot dot slash pub. And now it shows me something with pub at the end. You got something with pub at the end?
Yep.
You're ready. Okay. So now you can do an ls to look around if you like. That's all the files that happen to be in there. You probably don't have very many, but all the stuff you stuck there should have shown up in your ls. You can, if you want to, please don't do this now. You can type more space from the name of the file and it will list the file. Don't do that now. Okay. Now, what we're going to do is, if we go back to this spiffy web page that we found, it says, God, we have a lot of these, FS list ACL directory name. Okay, fine. So I'll do FS space listacl, all one word. That's list the access control list. And the directory I want to list is dot. The dot dot's the directory above me. Dot's the directory I'm in now. You know, it's a tree, and there's only one directory above me, and there's only one directory I'm in now, so I don't really need names. It's just the one above me and this one. All right? The one below me need names, because there are lots of them. Okay. So, FS list ACL dot, and these are all the people who can access my my directory. So, HTTPD is the web server. It's the HTTP daemon. It has the rights to read my directory. Which is good, because otherwise you couldn't see the web page. I got a couple of managers that can do it. And any user, that means you, can R it or L it. Okay? So we come back here and we find out what R and L mean. Okay. The rights can be any combination of R, L, I, D, W, K, and A. Which you can guess what they mean, but you can also just make it write, which gives all the rights except for the administrator right, or read, which gives read and lookup rights, so that's what RL is. You can read it, you can do a directory in it, you can do an LS to see what's there, and you can read a file. So what you want to give your friends is write permission. Okay, so I'll go back here, my Turk connects, and I'll imagine that I have a friend. So, FS, SCTACL, dot, my friend's name. Well, this actually should be your friend's address, right?
Address where?
What's that?
Address where? University address?
Email address.
Okay.
So, Turf Connect address. Login ID. Yeah, OARD. If you wanted to give me permission, you should make it OARD. Now, I don't have any friends, so I'm not gonna do this. Okay, but if you have a friend, you can do it. Now, having done that, then you can go to, did anybody give me permission to erase all their files? No, okay, good one. But I can go to, somebody give me their account name?
DT.
DT, I'll go to /pub/DKs. I'll do an LS. Now you see, because any user had R and L permission, I used the L permission to list it, now I'm gonna use the R permission to read it. So I can say more 690.html. Okay, fine, in the beginning, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and then I can just move the file, 690.html to 691.html. But I can't do that because I don't have the right permission, right? So if you gave your friend right permission, everything should be happy. But only if you're a friend, not for me. Ben, did you give somebody permission?
No.
There's no friends here.
No.
Got it? Okay, so the magic mumbo jumbo to get to this, AFS group permissions. Yes. So you can use this for working on the project. Not testable knowledge. Not going to come along and say, okay, so now set your access control list so I can delete a file. But because you asked, how can I share files with my friends, well, you can mail them back and forth, but then only you can put them in the directory, but this lets everybody write into the thing. Now all your friends can delete your files.
I tried to
experience
access, and it didn't
seem like a challenge. Oh, so there must have been some all or something. Sorry. So, FS, setAPL, dot, the name, and then you have to say write, W-R-I-T.
Okay.
I'm kidding. Thank you. Other questions on this? So, what I suggest that you do is make a friend before you leave tonight, give each other access, try writing something into the other's file, look at it on the web, see if it's there, confirm that it is, and then un-give each other access unless you don't like each other. And then you'll know that you all know how to do this for sharing stuff around your room. All right? If you have questions on it, you can come back next week. We can walk through it during lunch. Okay? We now return you to the incredibly arcane world of relational data. By the way, if you learn to use the editor on there, you can tune up your web pages without FTP again, which is sometimes handy. And the editor on there, there are several, but the easiest one to use is called Pico, P-I-C-O. So the only thing Pico doesn't let you do is you can't point and shoot. You have to use the up and down arrow buttons to get to where you want, but otherwise it works pretty transparent. And if you want to use my editor, it's Emacs. And by the end of the semester, you'll have it down. Emacs is like, it's a religion, not really just an Emacs. You can look it up, Emacs religion. In fact, the help in Emacs is so good that after you get to the last level of help, if it can't help you any further, it invokes a psychiatrist. I'm not kidding, it really does. It has a psychiatrist built in, which will ask you questions like, so, what problem are you having? Problem with my editor. Tell me more about your editor. My editor won't do what I want. You do what you want. So, in any case, it's actually built in. It's a program called ELIZA, and it's the only program to have ever passed the Turing test, which is the test to for a computer to see if it is if it's like a human. The way you do it is you put either a human or a computer on the other end, and you you then deny the knowledge of the user which one it is. You ask them, and if they can't tell, then the computer may as well have been human. And so one time somebody, was back in the early days, left Eliza connected to a dial-in machine. Somebody dialed in and sent a request, you know, would you please start my job or something. Eliza responded something like, tell me more about your job, and the job, and they said, I'm afraid I can't help you with that. And they actually thought they were talking to the operator for a little while. So that's the only known case of the brain death activity. So if you really want to have fun with editors, you have the meta key, X, and then dot, and that will invoke the highest level of help. Okay. So all the stuff that I just told you is really easy if you happen to have a stamp pad. You remember one of those, the things with the pads and the stamps, and you could stamp it, you know, deny or whatever? If you had a stamp that makes tables, it's great, right? You just choop, 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 stamp a bunch of tables down, and you're set. But if you want a shorthand, so you don't have to go out and buy a table stamp, right? Then people use entity relationship diagrams, because they're easier to draw than all them tables, because you don't really need the data if you're just trying to sketch out the structure. So you just want some way of showing how the tables are related. So it's a graphical visualization of the way in which the tables are connected, which we call the data model. Right? So this is the model of reality. We make the entities boxes, and we make the relationships lines between boxes. So that's all very abstract. Here's a real one. So we start out, a student has a student ID, a first name, a last name, a department, an email, and maybe right? We had a department table, we had a course table, and we had an enrollment table. Right? So we simply draw boxes, we put the name of the table at the top, we list all the fields that are in the table. Doesn't make any order what any difference what order they're in. We list them in any order that's convenient for us. And then this kind of tells us about the thing, right? You say, I don't really know what an enrollment is, but an enrollment is something that has a student and a course and a grade. Okay, well now I got a little bit of a sense for what enrollment is. And then we draw lines between the things. So for example, can I draw a line between an enrollment and a department? Well, I can have a student from that department enrolled, so there's some kind of a relationship, but there's not a direct relationship, right? Enrollments don't have departments. So it's useful to draw lines and say, these things don't stand by themselves, these things are used together, these things are used together. The lines are the things you can join. Right? So they sort of declare your intent to be able to join something. Now I haven't worried about primary keys, foreign keys, constricts, projects, didn't worry about any of that, I'm just drawing the picture. Right? So I've got an enrollment. The enrollment has a student and a course. And the student's associated with a department. Now, it might be that there are some students associated with two departments. Any Hill students here? So you're associated with two departments, right? So this wouldn't be a very good data model. Okay. So I would have to have some more complex data model, right, that would have like an association of students and the departments. Okay, clear what's going on? Just a shorthand way of drawing the tables. Now, you actually do this in the other direction. You start with an idea, and then with the idea you draw an ER diagram, an entity relationship diagram, and then with an ER diagram in front of you, you make some tables. Right? So this isn't the description of the tables, this is the description of the problem. So problem first, then an ER diagram, and then data. You're probably saying to yourself about now, how do I get started with ER modeling? Anyone think of that? So, naturally, since we're making a database, what you would think is, what data do I have? Right?
and that's the wrong place to start. For example, what data do you have about me? What do you know about me? PhD in engineering, I'm military ID, what else? I was a student here, what's that?
I teach 690.
I teach 690. I've been to San Francisco. Do you see where we're going with this? Right? And that's hardly anything, right? You didn't even get to my shoe size. All right? So, if you start by saying, what are the entities and what do I know about them? It'll never end. Remember the idea that a model is a representation of reality for a purpose. Right? It's a part of reality. So, it's the purpose that's going to be the key. So the first thing we have to do is say, what kind of questions do we want to be able to answer? Okay? After you know what kind of questions you want to be able to answer, then you can ask questions like, what kind of data do I need to answer these questions? Now, notice, I'm not using that term lightly. I mean, what kind of little atomic pieces of evidence about the world, facts about the world, do you need? What kinds of things that are data? Okay. Now, it will turn out that the data you need to answer the questions will come in two forms. It will be either things or relationships between things. Now this isn't really as clean as it seems. Because a relationship between something, between some pair of things, is itself a thing. Yes, it's a design decision whether you call something an entity or a relationship. And it doesn't matter at this point. Because the way that you represent entities is with tables. And the way you represent relationships is with joins. Or by putting things in the same table. Together. Collocation in the table. Or by putting things in a join table. Like the enrollment table. So there are three ways to represent relationships. And so we'll take whatever ER diagram you build, and we'll build the same set of tables off. But there are different ER diagrams that are equally valid. They're equally useful as an example. Okay, so first the question, then the data, and then, this is pretty obvious, how the data is used to answer the question. So those are the things to think about. So, without looking at the next slide, please. How many of you are going to join project teams? Good answer! Okay, good. So you all know about project teams, right? So, let's say that I wanted to build an ER diagram for project teams. Pretty obvious what's going to be in it, right? We're going to have people in it, we're going to have projects in it, we're going to have teams in it. Okay. Tell me what to do first. What kind of questions might you wish to answer about project teams? Okay, so given a team, list the people. I'm sorry, what was the second? Okay, given a team, find me their project.
You might want to know what their grade was for the project.
Given a team, find me their grade. Okay. Give me a team, tell me who the customer is. You're making this too easy.
Because I'm answering all the questions from given a team. But wouldn't you answer, wouldn't you ask other questions if you had this? Like, given a person, what's their grade? No? Given a description of a project, who's doing it? Okay, so these are the kinds of questions you'd have in mind. Good. What data do we need to be able to answer questions like that?
I really desperately want one more.
Yes. Thanks for that. Okay, very good. Well, I got two markers for each foot for one character, so we'll come ourselves with two character words. What data do we need? So, what are the entities?
Students.
What's that?
Student names as well.
Okay, people. Students.
Subject and project.
Subject. Project.
Client.
What's that?
Client.
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 Client. I was wondering the same thing, but I'm going to find out over the next second. Okay, so what's the difference between people and students? Students aren't people?
What's the difference between subject and project?
I had trouble with that one too. But hold on, let's say it was the students and people. Should we have students or people?
Students.
Students, okay. Are students clients?
No.
How do you know?
Could be.
Okay. Clients are people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Students are people.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think students can be clients?
Students can be clients.
A student,
thank you.
But so students can be a client?
Yes. In the same field at the same time, though.
What's that?
They can't be
a client and a student at the same time? You mean like there can't be a student over here who's a client for your project over there?
That can be okay, but there can't be
a client for their own
project.
Yes. But they could be a client for somebody else's project. I mean, they probably won't be, but they could.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I need students and I need clients and I need it to be possible for there to be somebody who is a student and a client. It means it might be useful to represent people because they have like names. And then I could represent specializations of people that are students and specializations of people that are clients.
Yeah.
It's only useful being way more complicated if you want to be able to answer questions about projects in which one student is a client. Right? Okay, so why was subjects and projects split?
If you have, or one asks the question, is it group using HTML, is it using CSS, is it using...
That's a subject.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. So, or we can call it a technology.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Ready for me.
But if you wanted to know if it was doing literature or history, that would be a subject.
Okay. Very good. So, this is the main step. How are they connected?
Projects have students.
Okay, projects.
Projects have teams that have students.
So you're saying that projects don't have students, projects have teams.
Right.
But on a project, could you have a student take a specific part of your project?
Yeah, but if they be, that's because they were on a team. This is clever, I hadn't thought of this one. Okay, so projects have teams. Teams have students. Thank you.
Okay, that's
Project has plans.
Or you could say the students have.
Teams that have plans, projects have plans. Okay.
How do you differentiate that?
What do you mean?
Like, to me, the student has to go out and find the client. So who has the client, the project or the student?
Or the team, because the team has the client.
Yeah, the team, because the team is servicing the client with a project.
Yeah, but the project's the actual project, you're giving the client.
Okay, so you could say it this way, or you could have the team have the client, and it would be the same.
Okay.
Or you could have a student have the client, in which case it wouldn't be the same. Because you'd be representing which student has the client. Maybe there's some role where one of the students is the client liaison, and that student has the client. Right? So that would have a different meaning. But it's actually not a different meaning between project and team. They both mean the same thing in reality. And that's because the relationship between projects and teams is one-to-one. A project has only one team doing it, and a team is only doing one project.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the end, what we're going to do is we're going to put these in the same table because there's no sense having them separate.
Mm-hmm.
They are the same thing. They're sort of the front and back of the coin. But you don't have to think about that at this point. Your question raises this issue, which will be solved when we make it into tables. Because they'll simply show up together, and both implementations will do that questionnaire. I see. So now you have to keep track of so now you're saying that a team could have more than one project in a company or something. I mean, in 690, hopefully they don't have one. But so we're representing only the case here, in which they're one-to-one. If you'd like them to be one-to-many, then we could make this one-to-many, which is really easy to do. Don't make that many. Right? And now a team can have many projects, and each project has one client, but a client can have many projects. Yep. So you see how easy it is before we make tables to just say, oh, many to one, one to one. It doesn't really matter, but it will change our implementation. Okay? So since I only want to do 690, I'll make that a one, but still a client can have many projects. Okay? Okay, good, so that's it, right? Did we get everything? Teams? Oh, we didn't get people. What? Where do people go? What's that? Yeah, so that's what you do. You go down here and you say, okay, I got this other thing, people, and you say, I've got two kinds of people, clients and students, all right? And I don't, there's some kind of a funny, I can never remember what it is, like that, or like that says that this isn't a has, this is a kind of.
What sort of question would you ever want to ask that would involve clients and students the eventual answers to the same question?
Well, let's say that I had a client who was, this is a direct answer to your question, but what kind of reason would I want to separate them. Let's say that I had a client who was a student and who had a phone number. And their phone number was the same, whether they were in their client role or in their student role.
Okay.
Their phone number is the same. So for normalization, I'd like to represent all the things that are true of people at a people table. And then for the people that happen to be clients, I would like to have an extra table that says whether they're mean or kind or something, you know, whatever I want for clients, detail oriented, whatever I want to keep track of. And for students, I might want to keep track of their grade, but I don't want to give grades to the clients, so I don't want to have a grade column in my people table.
Okay.
But you know, we give the same grade to the projects, to all students in the same project table. So we should actually not record the grade book for students, we should record the grade here. So now you can start to fill these out. Did we get through all these? We didn't get through subjects, we didn't get through technologies, right? So we can say a technology We can have a technology table, or we can just make a technology and atomic thing. Right? In which case we can give the technology to the project. So I can either make a technology table or link to it. Right? I can say the project has some number of technologies, or I can just list the technology if there's only one. What do I know about clients?
They have a need.
They have a what?
A need. Oh, they have a...
The need for the project.
A program, yes.
Well, the project may or may not be their need. But they just like be needy people and have needs, so they want to report.
The name of the person or organization that...
They have a problem that they want to...
So for a client, we want their name, right? Okay, but names are common to students, so we'll want that here.
Client has a desire, because it may not be a need.
Your need is a desire thing. Okay, so... But is the desire asking for a project is just a random desire, like they want to go to Tahiti? I mean, what kind of question are we going to ask of the database for which we need to record their need?
What project do they want to go?
That's this, right? The client has a project. The project has characteristics, that's great. So I think we've got the need represented here.
Well, the natural project doesn't fulfill the need.
Okay. What do needs have? You see the problem. The problem comes around what kind of questions you're asking. You can do this all day. Well, what else do I know about clients that I don't know about students? We already said the students we want to record their grade, right? But we got that up here.
Affiliation of clients?
Yeah, okay, so their affiliation. So I can answer questions now like, who's doing projects for Exxon? Okay, got the idea?
Name, corporate name versus student name?
So if you think of a client as being the corporation as opposed to being the student, or as opposed to being a person in the corporation, then you would think of the client as being not a person, but its own thing, and it would be then the corporation. So that's another way to model.
So then if you started it that way, if it had a corporation name and a student name, could you get rid of the people category?
Yes. They are in her world.
Oh. Well, even if you thought of like a person as a corporation or a business or a client name, then that way you won't have a people category.
Yeah, so you'll get a different outcome if you do this. Everybody now has to be a company. But you can incorporate yourself. Okay. So, I actually did this. And so you can see how this was done. So we had humans, which is probably a little reductionist for people. Okay, so we had humans. And humans had, humans could be either clients or students. So this is how we represented that choice. We've got teams and projects. The relationship between a team and a project is create. Right. We're going to call it have. Here's a client. Client needs the project. So somebody did want needs, and needs here were represented as the name of the relationship. So client needs project. And then the project might be one or another kind of a project that you might do. So the D meant this joint, you have to choose this or this. Whereas here, this meant that a human can be both the client and the student. A team only makes one project, and the project only has one team. A client has one project. Right?
a project may have many clients.
Oh, I did it.
This is a nasty one. A student can be a member of a team. So I have many students for one team. But the membership has a role. So the student on the team can have a management role. So every student might be the designer or the tester or the bug fixer. Right? And then they have an implementation role in that they might be working on the user interface or the database design or the HTML coding. So I've given this membership role more complexity than we've talked about. And this is going to result in a table that is a table for the role. So essentially what's going to happen is the role is going to come out of the thing. Okay.
So would it still be an entity if it's a role?
No, it's a relationship.
Relationship.
Between two entities. But it's a relationship that has attributes. And when you encounter relationships that have attributes, you normally land up coding a table. So now I have to take that, and I have to pick a primary key for every entity. So let's just do it. So what's the primary key for a human?
People.
What? What would be a unique identifier for a human?
Okay.
Will that be equally good for clients and for students?
Yes.
Sure. So I don't need primary keys here. Okay. What's a primary key for a team?
Would we have a team name?
You could have a team name, like the Bulldogs or something, right? All right. Or you have a team number if you like, a team letter, or a team color. Okay, fine. For a project?
Project name.
Maybe a project name, right? You might have a project letter or something. Okay, fine. Okay, so we have picked now primary keys for our entities. Now we'll build the tables. We'll build one table per entity. And then if we have any many-to-many relationships, we'll build a table for that. So here's a picture of one-to-one relationships. It says, this is always related to that, this is always related to that, this is related to that, this isn't related to anything, these things aren't related to anything. There's never more than one thing connected to any one of these. So this is one-to-one. Here, I can have many connections on this side, but always just one on this side. So this is one to many, one on this side and many on that side, or many to many, where I've got a couple things here, a couple things there. Anytime I get many to many, I need to build a table that will represent the connection. If I have one to many, that's easy. If I have one to one, it's still in the same table. If I have one to many, I just use a foreign key. But if I have many to many, I need two foreign keys, which get their own table. Okay? So many to many relationships spawn foreign tables. Which is why it was handy in our entity relationship diagram to indicate which was one to one. So one to one, team and project will be in the same table. Okay? All nods? Good. One to many. This says that a client, what's it, a team may have many students, a client may have many projects. Okay? So if I have a client who can have many projects, would I put the foreign key in client or in project? I put it in project because every project has only one client. All right? And if I did it the other way, I'd have to list lots of foreign keys, which wouldn't make sense. So that's why the one to many's don't require me to make an extra table, but the many to many's, there's no good place to put them. Remember I told you that one table at the bottom was the answer to every exam question ever asked? That's the many to many table. That's the enrollment table. Many students take many classes. Okay, then you should choose memorable field names and memorable names for your tables. Yes, that's great. Now remember, you might have had to make up a table for a many-to-many relationship, which means you might have to make up a name for that. But you should also choose relatively terse names because you're going to have to type them in and read them on the screen. Okay, then what you do is you do normalization. So you take your initial table design and you factor it a little bit, so that you get a nice, clean design where everything is as simple as it can possibly be, and then just type it into the relational database, and you're on the run. Okay, so, Codd had to publish several papers on this just to get famous academically, and so he had to make up names for things. So he made up normal forms. And so these are five of his normal forms. And so Codd says, in first normal form, you have single-valued indivisible attributes, which he calls atomic. Now realize he's writing this in the 1960s, so he's got like atomic on the brain, right? But atomic, indivisible. That's what he's thinking here. So, for example, you have to decide now, maybe you had student name, you have to decide now whether you want that to be first name, last name, or whether you just want it to be student name, or do you want it to be first name, last name, middle initial, or first name, last name, middle name, or whatever it's going to be. Okay? All right. And if you have any many to many's, and you haven't fixed them yet, you have to fix them in order to earn your first normal form. Then you got a little note on your forehead that says first normal form. Right? But you can do better. So, if you have something where you have the ID and the implementation role acting as a compound key, so you should try to avoid this in the first place, but if you end up with this, and it turns out that the implementation role can be defined just from the ID, it doesn't depend on the name, you should split these into two tables. So, if you don't have a compound primary key, you can't have this problem. The third thing is that attributes should depend directly on the primary key, which is to say, if I tell you the primary key, you should be able to tell me the value of the attribute. So, for example, we often have things like ID should be the address, the city, the state, and the zip, right? So ID is the primary key, and then you get the street address, the city, the state, and zip. And in fact, people really make databases this way. But this violates third normal form. Because in third normal form, you would have the ID, the address, and the zip code, and from the zip code, you can figure out the city and the state. Right? Now, the reason people don't do this is because whenever you want the address, you end up having to do a join. And the joins are expensive. So people store the denormalized table in this form, violating third normal form, intentionally. And it goes on. So it's really that first normal form that you need to pay attention to. You need to make sure that you've broken up the atomic elements, or the elements that aren't atomic, to the point where they are.
this is a shorthand version of the resulting table. These are simply all the field names with none of the data so far. So it says, I'll represent a person as a first name and last name, a user ID and a password. As I decided I wanted the user ID and password. I'll represent a student as an ID, which is the ID here. Right? Because a student is a person, and will additionally have a team and a management role. So this allows every student to have only one management role. I had to build an implementation roles table that would take an ID and allow you to have multiple implementation roles, because you might work in multiple parts of your project. For the role, I had to have a way of printing it out, so I had a code for the role and a string, so I didn't have to type that string in every time I had a role. And then a role here could either be an I role or an M role. Then every project had a team that was doing it, and it had a client, a P string, and what the heck is a P string? Had a contact from every ID, every contact was a contact per person. And because I might have a phone number and an email address, I had a contact type, which was either phone number or email address, and then the contact string, which was the phone number or the email address. And then I had to have a feedback label for every contact type that would tell me what was going on. I'm guessing it is, yes. Yeah. The name of the project. But first, but memorable. This just wasn't memorable. Okay, clear how we got here? If I gave you a problem, you could actually build an ER diagram, and then with your ER diagram, you could build it. Okay. When I give you a problem next week that has that structure, you know enough to work through it and ask those questions. So that's what we're going to do next week. Okay. So, if you really get hung up on this, you ultimately will make things that look like this.
Wow.
Sorry. Let's, yeah. Let's take 5 minutes break and then we'll come back and finish up.
Thank you.
Sitting here for a couple of hours, right? You're very smart, right? And you still don't quite have it, right? What do you bet the computer, which is stupid, is not going to get this right? Okay, so this is sort of like something that the people who work on databases in academia can keep working on, okay? The alternative is to use the structured query language. Now, the beauty of the relational algebra is that it's a mathematical formulation. We can write an exact, in words, way of saying it, just like in algebra.
all these weird symbols and stuff. And so the structured query language is designed to, no matter which database management system you have, it reads in the same specifications. It doesn't use weird symbols and stuff because they're not on your keyboard. So instead what it does, I mean, the symbol for a join is, you know, straight out of the Richard D. So we don't use weird symbols. What we do is we use words that translate directly into the weird symbols. And they're wiggling English-like things. So you can say, for example, select last name from students where department was list, right? So it's really easy. If we're joining last name or something, right? Okay, that's the last name part, or that's the joining part. We're selecting last name. We're joining students with nothing. We're projecting last name, and we're restricting where department was list. So if you learn the lingo, you can write these things. Just say, oh, bring these things together, and then, you know, project this way, restrict that way, we're done. Okay? You can learn to write that lingo. So real database programmers program in SQL. They don't even say SQL. You're not a real database programmer. You say SQL. Right? You say SQL. In the end crap. Okay. But Microsoft Access has visual programming. So what visual programming is you want this column? Check the box. You want these rows? Write the little formula here, and I'll get those rows. So you don't have to remember all the stuff around it. You do have to know the same thing. You can't not design the database or not design the queries. It's just easier to specify them and easier to write them. So I'll teach you visual programming, and then inside Microsoft Access, there's a command that says, what's the SQL for this? And so if you ever want to impress your friends at the bar, right, you can visually program it and then print out the SQL and bring it with you. And that will turn out to be important because we will later connect the database to our web page and we have to use SQL to do that. And still, you'll call it naked in Microsoft Word. The SQL type it in your web page because it's easier than learning to do SQL. Scratch. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Let's bring up Microsoft Access. Well, let's make this up from scratch. So you go to Microsoft Office. Inside Microsoft Office, there's Microsoft Access, which I've already loaded. And when you get there, it looks like this, which is pretty dandy. So I'll make a new blank database. So I went to File. New blank database. With me? Everybody got it? Okay, good. So I have to save the name of the database, so I'll just call it test, and I'm going to take it as C because it won't let me save anything anyplace else. This will go away before next week, but I'm glad that happened. And I got this thing called test.mdb, and it's got nothing in it. Now look, databases can have tables, and they can have queries, and everything else here is a complete waste of your time. The forms make it look nice, the reports make it look nice on paper, the forms make it look nice on the screen, you know, so you can do all sorts of stuff, but really the whole game is tables and queries. Alright? And there ain't no sense making queries until you got some tables, so we'll get some tables. Okay, now you can make your tables in the design view, you can make your tables by using a wizard, or you can create a table by just typing data in and hoping for the best. Alright? So I like to make my tables in design view. Your mileage may vary. I don't care what you do. So I'm going to go to design view. Okay, so let's do a student table. Now one of the things that I hate about Access is that now that I know I want to do the student table, I want to write student someplace, but it doesn't want that. It's going to ask me what I want to save it as when I'm done. So I have to kind of remember this as a student table. So what do I have about students? What do I know about students?
Name,
okay. Last name, first name, last name. Okay, so I got last name. What kind of name is that going to be? The pick what you make for last name, currency? How about number? Maybe a text? Yeah, let's go for text. Okay. Yeah, what else does student say? Okay, and what do you think that should be?
We'll make that. Okay, what else, Lane?
ID number.
ID number, okay. And what should we make that?
Number.
Make that a number. I'm going to make that an auto number. That way, when I put in the student, I won't even have to think of what number goes there. It'll pick a number and throw it. Okay, so it's an auto number. You can control the number if you want to. You just have to make sure if you can use the primary key that it becomes unique. The auto number does it become unique, but then you won't know what number it's picking. So you can have it either way. Okay, anything else we know about students?
Birthday.
Birthday. Oh, so we can send them a birthday card. That's a great idea. What should we make that? Date. Okay. So dates and times are the same thing as far as concerned. And what else might we know about students? Their department. Okay, so we got a department, and we'll not be text again. Okay, I'm going to go back and make my auto number a number just to be simple here. Remember later you can make them an auto number, but I'm going to make it a number. Okay, and give me one more thing I'm going to know about students. Their what? Email. Somebody said contact.
Contact number.
Contact. Phone number. Let's do phone number. I like that. Okay, your phone number. Your phone number is what? Number, but it won't work. We'll make it a number, and I'll show you later why that's a really bad idea. Okay, fine. So, we're done. So, we can close it. Now, I can never remember in Microsoft Access what you're supposed to say and what you're not supposed to say. If there's something you're supposed to say and something else you're not supposed to say. But if you close it, it will tell you. Oh, you forgot to save it. See? This could be very bad. I should be getting a little pop-up about
it. Do you want to save
two? Do you want to? Did you get one?
Yeah, immediately.
Well, you did much better than I did, clearly.
Save as. Yes.
There we go. You want to save changes? Yes. Save as, and now I can give the table a name, and it offers me table one, which is really bad, because now I want to say, what was this table again? Students. Okay, so I'm going to make a student. No primary key is defined. Do I want to create one now? I'm going to say no. Actually, I'm going to say cancel. Okay. Because I had in mind that this ID was going to be a primary key, so I will come up here to ID, and I will right-click and hit primary key. And in that cube, I get a little picture of a key. Okay? Now we can try to get rid of it again. Do you want to save the changes? You betcha. What do you want to call it? Student? Okay, fine. Okay, now I've got a student table. You see that? And now I can create another table in Design View. And I'll make that something that has a student, so I can build a link. Okay, so what would I want to link with students? A course. Okay, fine. So give me a field name for courses. What do courses have? Course number. And that, what kind of data type? What's that? Number. Okay. What else? Description. Okay, what kind of data type? Text. Okay, what else? Department. Okay. How about that? Text. Okay, that's enough. Okay, let's save it. Oh, you want to save the changes? Yes. Call it course number, and I'll call it course. Okay. Oh my god, I forgot my primary key! Cancel. Back here, you want to make the course number primary key? Primary key. All that hassle again, you want to save it, do that. Call it what? Course. Okay, great. So I got courses, I got students. Wait a minute, my course didn't have any students in it. So do I need a table to join courses and students? Okay, so I'll make the course to join tables and students. What should it have? Source number, which is a number, right? And SIN, what was SIN number called? What's that? ID. I'm going to call student ID here. And that's a number two. Okay. And we'll say this one. Okay, thank you. You gotcha. What's this called? An enrollment, maybe? Okay. You want to make a primary key? I'm going to let it make a primary key for me. Okay. So now if I open enrollment in the design view, you'll see that I've got a field that it chose the name ID, which is why I didn't like ID earlier, and it made it the primary key, and it's an auto number. So if you let it make the primary key for you, that's what it will do. Okay? Now to open that in design view, I clicked on enrollment with right click, and then hit design view. Okay? Good. So let's go stick some data in. Yeah.
If you created something
with
primary key by accident,
can you recognize it? I suppose you could right click on primary key and that'll go away. Will that work?
No, I clicked on the
other one.
Yeah. And now it's
just
going to the table.
Oh, no, you have to open it in design view. Oh. Right click, second down is design view. Open in design view. You see it there?
Yeah.
Okay. And then does the right click get rid of the primary key?
Yep.
Good. Okay, very good. Now let's take some data in here, right? So let's pick up a course. So what's the course number? LDSC690, right? Description. Oh my God, we can't put LDSC690 in the course number. Why not? It's protecting us from ourselves. Okay, fine. So that's what it's doing there. This is a principle of programming, is you should always protect the programmer from themselves because people make mistakes. All right? So you get people to tell you what they expect to put there and then make sure they put it there. Okay, so just for simplicity, we'll call it 690. What do you want to say about 690? Okay, let's do the same thing for students. Give me a last name. Yeah. First name?
John.
John Smith's ID number? 1234. John Smith's birthday? January 5th, what?
1999.
Department? Engineering. Phone number?
555-1212.
1212. Just like in the movie. Okay. Oh my God, that's not a number. Yeah, you always make phone numbers text.
Because
they're not numbers. They got a dash. So it's you can blame that on the English language. So in the meantime, we'll have no data. Did you ever have one of these things where you had to type the phone number some specific way? That's because of it. Okay, because some idiot made it a number. Okay, fine. So now you can be the idiot. Okay, what's next?
Joe.
Jane Doe. Yeah. 5678. Okay. Birthday?
10/20/1968.
10 20, 19, 60. Is that a famous birthday?
Maybe.
I think. Department.
Horticulture.
Okay. Phone number? I'm 5512, Jane Doe, Elizabeth Jones Smith. Okay. But we're fine there. Let's do an enrollment. So the enrollment, we're auto numbered here, so we don't have to worry about it. What's the card number?
640.
Which student? 1, 2, 3, 4. You see the problem with picking weird numbers? Now you've got to remember it. And that would have been the problem with auto numbering. You would have had to look back to see what number was assigned before you could fill it in here. So it's fine if you're doing it with a program, but you actually very rarely auto number. You only auto number when you're never going to use that primary key. Okay. So who next? After 640, what else? 690. Who's taking 690? 5, 6, 7, 8, okay, but we're not really using our capability here being many to many, so somebody's got to take something else.
690.
690 again, popular course. Who?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Good, that's enough. We're done. Okay, so we're done with tables, we've got our tables, are populated. You can look at them if you like, you just click on them and you get to see them. Or you can right click and hit open. So those are your tables. Okay, so now it's time to do a query. So here's queries. Okay, so we want to, I like to create the queries in design view. Your mileage may vary. So we'll create a query in design view. Okay, now I want to know which tables do we want. So this is bizarre. I never get this right. You pick the table you want and you hit add. Okay, boss, so we got it. Now you pick the table you want and you hit add. And you pick the table you want, and you hit add, and then you hit close. And if you forget to hit close, you can't do anything else. Okay, so there we go. And it built my drawings for me automatically. What's that?
Why does it connect from enrollment to student?
Yours does not connect from enrollment to student. Okay.
It connected from course to enrollment. But it doesn't have the line connecting it from the enrollment.
Did you write like ID and ID number? Because I did, and I think that's why. You cannot say it.
Oh, yeah.
But that one's wrong anyway.
Because I
think
ID. Oh, I put it.
No, it doesn't seem to be case sensitive with caps.
But
how
you
do
don't
we
want those two
that?
IDs to connect anyway.
Okay, but we don't want those two IDs to connect anyway.
You want it to be student ID and ID, not random number ID.
Right, and why does my student not have a student ID in it?
Because you didn't write that.
Yeah. I did. Oh, no, it has an ID. I see, so I want this student ID to connect to that ID. So the ID in student should be connected to student ID, not to the ID in enrollment, which is the primary key of enrollment. See the problem? Okay, so I actually cooked this problem on purpose. And you confused my
friend. Could you explain that one more time, please?
Okay, fine. So the course number in course should link to the course number in enrollment, right? And the student ID in enrollment should link to the student ID in student. But there is no student ID in student. In student, we called it ID. But the machine is stupid, and it sees we have an ID in enrollment, which is automatically defined. It's the primary key, which we don't really want to use for anything, and it links ID to ID. Right? It's just trying to be helpful. But we don't really want it to be helpful. So we click on the nice helpful link and we hit delete. Okay? And then we go over here to first number to student ID, we drag it to ID, and it builds the link the way we want. Okay? Now, this is really more fun than you're entitled to, but I'll show you how you can have fun with these things. You can drag them over here, you can drag them down there, you can drag them over here, you can drag them up that way, you can stick this thing over there, and that's it. So, if you ever wanted to make an ER diagram, you make it in Access, because that's an ER diagram, and the big problem with ER diagrams in PowerPoint is getting them laid out correctly. Okay, with me? Okay, now, these arrows They're called joins. Oh my God, we can see them. It's getting a whole lot easier. Okay? Less abstract. Very good. So let's find out the first name of everybody in 690. Why not, right? So what do we do? Where do we find first names? We find them in students. All right? So we'll just go to table students, and we'll go to field first name. And we'll show. And then over here, we want to go to table course, and we want to make the course number, and the criteria will be equals 690. And we won't print 690. So I uncheck the box. And then just to see if it's any good, I'll come up here to the red exclamation point, which you would think you would never click on a red exclamation point, but it turns out it means run. So we'll run it, and we find out that Jane and John are taking 690, which is the right answer, and it's not at all. Well, now you have something to work on this week. But before you go, so next week what we will do is we will start with a problem, make up an ER diagram, make up some tables, type them into the to access, put the data in, enter the query, and run the query and get the results. So everything we just did today, except not with me talking, with you doing it, working in groups for the parts where you're doing the design, and then working individually for the parts where you're putting things in, building the database. And then we'll have some canned data that you can just copy over so that after you've typed in a few rows, you don't have to copy the whole. You know, so everybody type 50 things. Right? And then do a query on the canned. And we'll also talk about some of the more advanced things in databases that we didn't get to today. Like how to connect them to web pages. Okay. You shouldn't have asked, but since you did, so where did you see this? Did you see this in a project description written someplace that's not linked to this? It's on your term preference. Okay. So I screwed up because I'm just working off of this. I'm happy to have you do project presentations next week, but you would probably prefer to do them like a week after we had discussed them.
Yeah.
So why don't we move that back a week? Okay. And if I could get a money point from you, that would be great. If you had a money point.
I don't.
Okay.